Welcome to a thorough investigation into the underlying misogynistic stereotypes in 18th century French literature. Nah, I'm only kidding. You're safe from any of that highfalutin nonsense here. This is the Failing Writers Podcast.
Getting quite used to Dave not being here. It's quite nice, isn't it?
Yeah, do you know,
I think it's better. Is it better without him or not? I don't want to.
I mean,
this will be the third week without Dave.
And I missed him the first couple.
Yeah, but then
I
it kind of.
Yeah.
All right, lads. Hey,
oh, Dave.
I'm back.
Oh, it's so great you're back.
All right, hey, Davey.
Hey, yeah, Dave's back.
It's good to be back.
Get in. Oh. That's great news.
I was thinking, though, this is like we do all this big, do a shtick about the fact that I haven't been here for a few weeks. And then anyone listening goes, it's Dave. Has he not been here?
Has Dave not been here?
I hadn't noticed. Though I had wondered why I'd specifically enjoyed the last 2 weeks. But it's great to be back. It is. It's wonderful to be here. I would say I feel refreshed, but that's not true. But it's lovely to be back.
Tell you what, Dave, just to make you feel better and take some of that stress away from you, why don't we ask you what have you been writing this week?
Well, actually, I have actually written something.
What?
Believe it or
Come
not.
Because
one of the many reasons why I haven't been here last week.
You got like an agent or you got a film deal. What's been going on?
Exactly, yeah. I was on Jonathan Ross.
Oh, man.
No. Last week, I was in a hotel in Suffolk preparing for a big meeting. But I wasn't actually preparing for a big meeting because I realised that this was the first night in ages I'd actually had off. I didn't have to do any sort of tea times or bedtimes or getting ready for school or anything like that. It was just, do you know what? It's just me in a hotel room. What else am I going to do?
Whoa, I don't think we need the...
And after I did that, I thought, you know, I'll write something. So I actually sat down and I wrote a few little bits and bobs for our forthcoming sitcom pitch.
What?
Yeah, so I've written a couple of little bits.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
We've been writing some stuff for that. Tommy, you've written a little bit, haven't you?
No, I haven't.
Oh. I was thinking we've probably written half the script by now. We've probably written half of episode.
Well, Tom, you wrote out the little character things for us.
I did, yeah. It's kind of tweaked through that a bit. Yeah, I've not been able to get back on it, actually. Partly because I have started the other thing that I sent through, which was what Joanna Penn suggested that we write, the Failing Writer's Guide, and kind of...
Yeah.
Yes. Another project.
Because
yes,
that's what we need now. We need another project.
Yeah, but you know, I got quite excited. Yeah. I thought, oh, man, you see it in your head. I could see it and I could see how it worked with like having bits of dialogue in it as well as the... So, yeah. So I did 1,000 or so words on that and thought, oh, hold on a minute. Yeah. Let's do that as well.
Yeah, it is a good idea.
So I've been doing that. And as I promised myself, I've still been sending off some unfunny lines to... DMs are open.
Don't say unfunny, Tom. I bet they're very funny.
The last ones weren't, and I told you, I spoke to you, John, last time.
I think you've convinced yourself they're not funny. Or you're trying to write too hard. You're trying to squeeze it out.
No, I think I tried to write for them.
What they would want.
Rather than writing for me.
You can't do that.
This week's were a little bit better, I think, in terms of that.
But, all right.
I mean, we hold out no hope, but I think part of it was just promising to actually see it to the end for once, which literally will be the first time I've ever done that.
Well done, Tom.
Kudos, man.
Yeah, well done indeed. Yeah. I didn't get around to doing anything for that.
What about you, John?
Well, you know that I had plans to take my little like mini notebook with me, and I was going to sit in a cafe.
On your holiday,
I've been on holiday, yeah. I've been in Nice.
Nice.
But it turns out they've got some quite nice...
Where the biscuits come from.
Yes, exactly. It turns out they've got some quite nice wines and food and bike rides there. So
really?
I just took up too much time in the end. They've got nice beaches as well.
I wouldn't have expected that.
No, exactly. I didn't. But there you are. So I got distracted and I didn't.
So you haven't done anything?
Not a single thing.
Oh, well.
Quite a good excuse.
Hang on. So have I the only one who has actually written
something? I
think it has
been.
Well, I've literally just told you I've written something.
Yeah, but yeah,
that does count.
Well, okay. All right. Yeah. Fair enough.
Good
yeah,
point.
That does count.
Yeah.
And you've been on holiday, John. So, but that means we've all had successful, productive weeks.
Yeah.
If you can call a holiday productive.
It was. Yeah. No. It. You need holidays, don't you? You refresh your brain, get back into it. So yeah, I'm gonna go with that. Yeah.
Great. Well done. Well done, everyone. Little pat on the back.
So that's good. So you weren't in the shop buying paneer or trying to think of a word that rhymes with orange, Dave?
No. It wasn't any of those things, okay. But good guesses. Good guess, not quite right. Mm. So
today, chaps,
yes.
we're thinking about film, aren't we?
Are we? Yes, let's do that. Mm, I'm thinking about a film right now. Guess what film I'm thinking
of. Is it Shawshank Redemption?
Die Hard.
No.
Jaws.
No.
Damn.
This could take up most of the episode.
Yeah, it's good filler.
Yeah.
Have a guess at home. If you're listening now,
yeah.
Have a guess.
Yeah.
Let them have a guess.
Write in, and I'll send a personal prize to anyone who gets it right.
Well, let them have a guess now, and then you just say what it is.
Yeah, just reveal it.
So give them like 2 or 3 seconds to have a... Right, make your guess now. Don't change it. Be honest with us. Dave, what's the film?
The Croods 2.
Right, no one got that.
No, no one got that.
Now, we're thinking about good films, Dave.
Well, my just, you know what it's like when your kid gets obsessed with a movie and just watches it over and over again?
No, because I don't allow it. They will watch something new and something I want to watch. Why would you do that? You ever seen a 3-year-old's face while they're watching the start of Goodfellas? I tell you, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I was trying to think of great films with great screenplays, you know, specifically really well written. And but my brain always freezes in those situations.
Yeah, I find it. If anyone ever says, "What's your favourite thing?" I find that as difficult as putting a numbered rating on anything. I just can't.
Really?
Yeah,
it's
well,
really
I'm the
hard.
Same,
there's
yeah.
so many to choose from, aren't there?
You just have to pick one. Just pick one.
I can't pick one.
Oh, I know. I've got a film that I associate with you, Dave.
Really?
Yeah. Is it Clarks or Clerks?
Oh yeah, the Kevin Smith.
Well, you were a big fan of that.
Yes, I was a big fan of Kevin Smith.
Yeah, films like that make you quite excited about writing as well, I think, because they make you realise that a really good script does a lot of the heavy lifting in a film.
And that was a proper, like, homemade, self-made thing
That's
as well.
It
was like, wrote it, raised some money, got everything together, was in it, and it spawned a whole career.
Mm. Well, there was a great sort of period, wasn't it? After the 80s had gone... Where you got lots of...
You mean
of,
the 90s?
You got lots of stuff. Don't ruin it, Dave. I was going to go up
sorry,
to that.
Sorry.
You spoil
sorry.
That now.
I thought it was a guessing game.
No. But after in the 80s, there was lots of kind of like proper story films that kind of were just a story within themselves. They weren't trying to be part of a franchise or anything. Mm-hmm. And that was great. But then...
Top Gun.
Exactly.
Willow.
Yeah, it was a classic model, wasn't it? It was a classic
dark
formula.
The Goonies. All sort of things like that.
Yeah.
And then in the 90s... Things got a little bit more arty in places, didn't they? Even with mainstream stuff like Pulp Fiction and what have you, there was that
Tarantino,
kind of...
Tarantino, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
I was going to say that was very much Tarantino-led.
But then you did get the stuff that was just slightly off-piste and almost like arty film festival stuff. Like I was thinking about when you said that about Clerks, the stuff that came out like Being John Malkovich and things like that were just...
Yeah.
They would never get made now.
Quirky films still get made, don't they? They're just not on at the cinema, that's the thing.
No, but that's what I mean. It was mainstream, wasn't it? And the one-off films that were just a good script that got picked up. You know, like Trainspotting or Demolition Man.
good
stuff.
Now it's got to be a sequel, really, hasn't
or
it?
Or a reboot or something. I mean, I get it, because people are putting millions of pounds into these things and they want some return. They're not doing it for fun going, well, I quite like that. Let's give it a go. There's 20 million quid. Go on.
It's a bit, like, you know, when you don't get to eat out that often. When you do go to a restaurant, you think, oh, well, I always have that. But I know it's good and I don't want to waste my one chance of having a meal.
Yeah. And you con yourself. You're looking at the menu and you're conning yourself. I might try something different. Then the waiter turns up and you just go, Lambda Piazza, please.
Yeah. That's basically
that's what you always
the process
have.
That film producers and executives go through, I think, isn't it? Mm. They have this menu of new scripts and screenplays.
And that's why we only get the odd one, though. You get, you know, I don't know, something like 1917 or something, but that has to have a massive sort of director behind it and everything for it to exist as a thing. But I think back in the 80s and 90s, you'd get Groundhog Days and Ghostbusters and all these things that were just like off-the-wall separate concepts
still,
that were just...
I think there's still a strong independent film industry. I just think... It's maybe just a bit quieter.
I sound like an old grumpy person now, but I think that's missing. That's missing, isn't
you
it?
You are an old grumpy person.
Yeah. I think it's just further down. It's further down the food chain.
I
now.
I don't know. Is it that they used to be? It used to be enough to like attach a star to something. I'm not sure that's quite enough now. Like you say, it's got to be a reboot or a sequel or part of some kind of series. But in the movies you're talking about in the 80s, as long as you had a star attached to it, you'd go and see the new Bill Murray film. or the new Steve Martin film.
Yes, no, you'd say like that. No, you would. You're right. Yeah,
so
yeah.
It was just, you know, it's a series in so much as it had that guy that you liked from the last film in it, or an Arnie film, or, you know, a Sylvester Stallone movie. So maybe we've just gone past the age of the megastar.
Maybe. Maybe. We don't really know anything about film, do we? We should probably...
No.
We really don't. Probably move on to talking to Paul, because he knows loads about film.
Let's talk to someone who knows about film. So today, very excitingly, we're being joined by a TV director I used to work with called Paul Quinn.
I have become addicted to the podcast and have listened to 14 episodes in 6 days.
Wow, oh,
that's nice.
That's good, isn't
it? That's not good. That's a cry for help.
Well, I mean, I would say my work has taken has suffered slightly, but my dog is getting twice as long walks as she usually does because that's the only time I get to listen to stuff. So,
oh, that's good to hear, man. Very good.
Yeah, no, I really genuinely love it, and I find myself laughing constantly as well, which is always lovely.
That's good. It's always nice to hear people fail, isn't
it? Yeah.
Worse than you.
Yeah, I am definitely, I can relate to failure big time. So it's also nice to hear people who...
You've come to the right place.
Similar stories.
Yes. We're upfront about it.
Yes.
Yeah. The internet is sometimes a place where people go to pretend that their life is amazing. And I think we decided quite early on
We weren't very good at that. We weren't very good at the pretending, were we, either? So
it was just it was getting fed up, wasn't it, of the metaphorical picture of people's legs on holiday, kind of, you know, in the Instagram posts,
Facebook posts
of just the beach and the sea and everything, just with their feet going, oh, another busy week off. Oh, fuck off. Perfect life.
Yeah, you really don't want to see my feet. No one wants to see my feet, so yeah. Better that we're doing this.
I kind of find, though, that I suppose once you get to that point where you admit you're failing at something, because I think for years and years I used to always tell people, yeah, I'm writing these scripts, I'm going to try and get a film made, I'm doing this, that and the other, and I would be doing it, but then, you know, I'd sit on my arse and actually never send them to anyone, or wouldn't like, you know, I know the concept of opening up a document and writing something down, but I didn't have a clue what to do afterwards. So once you get past like 10 years of telling people, yeah, I'm working on a film, you kind of have to admit you're failing. And once you admit you're failing, weirdly, then the slight embarrassment caused by that makes you try and do something about it.
Well, I think it makes it much easier, doesn't it? Because everything after that is a bit better than failing.
Exactly.
Whereas the other way around, everything is a bit worse than actually doing something.
Yeah.
You're just reframing.
You're your own worst enemy, weirdly, when you're like, when you're failing by not putting stuff out into the world. Because effectively, the only thing that's making you fail is yourself. And all anyone else can do, if you do share it with the world, is agree with your kind of personal thoughts that you're rubbish at it. That's the worst thing that can happen, though. I mean, and anything better than that is an improvement on how you already feel about it if you're not sharing.
But
yourself,
that's the comforting thing, isn't it?
So it's I think that's when, you know, when I realized, oh God, I'm going to turn 40 and I'm still talking about doing something, is when I decided to actually maybe start sharing things.
Anyway, enough interesting chit-chat. Shall we get on with the podcast?
You're listening to the Failing Writers Podcast. Now officially the Dominican Republic's 378th favorite podcast.
Yeah, I had a feeling you might fit right in to our little club.
Wow, how to insult someone as soon as they come on.
Oh, yeah, well,
let me explain the reason for that. It's because, well, the reason you're on the podcast is that you recently posted on LinkedIn about an award that you won at the British Independent Film Festival.
He doesn't like to talk about it. Oh, no, I mean, no, he does. He put it on LinkedIn.
No, he's scared to talk about it. Yeah. And, so the category was, and I love this category, the category was Best Unproduced Screenplay.
It is good, though.
And I love that. There should be more of that kind of thing, I think, because it's so incredibly hard to get anything greenlit, get anything produced. And I like the idea of that. But the bit that caught my eye was a passage that said, this is quoting you, after years of wanting to be a writer, but being afraid to call myself one, as I'd beavered away without success, this gives me the confidence to keep going and maybe to start believing a little bit more. And I thought, that's our man. Get him on.
Yeah, absolutely. that's also, thinking about it, that's got to be the hardest category to win, because there's got to be way more unproduced screenplays in the world than produced ones, haven't there?
Yeah, well, I'd imagine for, like, you know, every 10,000 screenplays written, especially on spec, which means that no one's commissioned you to write it and you're doing it off your own back and then trying to find, you know, someone to make it. You know, for every 10,000 of those made, there might be, you know, 100 that get read, and then, you know, one, if we're lucky, that gets made. And that's and that's probably giving it good odds. You know, the odds are actually probably far much kind of more against it. And to me, it was it came from one of these moments of, you know, I've written probably in the last 3 years a screenplay a year, one of which was one I kind of went back to from years ago. And the others were kind of two kind of brand new ones. And I kind of, at some point approaching turning 40, I thought, right, it's time to, you know, get on with it and try this thing that you keep talking about. And I started writing them, and I found this guy who's like a producer who, I won't say his name, but he produces with like quite a big Hollywood star. I met him at a party and he was like, oh, send me your stuff. And so I sent him a couple of things and he was very nice about it. And he was like, well, and he was very complimentary about what I'd written. And he said, oh, you should do this, get an agent. And I was like, okay, how do I do that? And he was like, well, send it to some agents. And I was like, okay. So, you know, I literally kind of found a list of every agent I could find on the internet based in London, sent it to them. A couple came back saying they weren't interested. Others just didn't reply at all. And I kind of went back to him, and then he said, oh, well, I'll send it to this huge agent in America. And then they obviously never came back. So my default setting then is, well, I tried. Okay, I'll move on. I'll write another one. And then something happened that completely energized me and changed my perspective, which is I came across this website, which I'm not sure you're aware of, called Film Freeway.
Oh, no.
And what Film Freeway does, which is just one of these things that you'd think I would have read on a blog or on a film website, because films are my life. That's what I love. Film Freeway, it takes filmmakers and writers, and it allows them to upload their short films, feature films, and screenplays to basically their hub.
Right.
And then what it does is it basically lists, it feels like, every film festival film awards competition in the world. And all you do is go, great, I want to enter that one. I want to enter that one. And it does all the work for you. Because for me, once I've written something, I mean, I'm at heart an incredibly lazy person. and I'm not a producer. I need a producer who wants to champion my work. And I don't have that. So the second I start reading or kind of Googling how to do things, how to find an agent, my mind just goes somewhere else. And then I just end up, like, you know, watching YouTube videos and forgetting all about it.
Yeah.
And Film Freeway basically just said, you know, we'll do all the hard work for you.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it really has changed. I'm not going to say changed my life, because it's like, you know, nothing. I've actually still not achieved anything from this. but what it did was it allowed me to go, okay, so this script in particular that John's referring to, which is Pushing Daisy, is quite a small scale. You know, I wrote it during lockdown specifically, somewhat cynically to begin with, to be small and cheap so that potentially I could try and get it funded myself. And then in reality, it became incredibly personal to me as I kind of found my way through the story. But it was like, okay, I've got this script now. I can go through Film Freeway and identify all the festivals and things which I think maybe it's suited to. So independent film festivals, smaller things.
Yeah. And does every festival tend to have a category like that, that are best unproduced?
This is the thing. The vast majority of them don't. I mean, there are lots of screenwriting festivals and screenwriting awards, which obviously are catered to finding new talent and unproduced scripts. So kind of those are their own thing. But then what I found is that there are the occasional kind of film festivals and independent festivals, especially the independent ones, because their kind of whole modus operandi is to find new talent and introduce it to the world.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's in their interest to kind of, you know, help people along that journey. So yeah, so I entered Pushing Daisy into the British Independent Film Festival, among others. Not many, I think 4 or 5 overall. So that was probably the tail end of last year. And then about a month ago, I get a message saying, congratulations, you've been selected as part of the gold list.
Sounds good though, doesn't it? Gold list.
Yeah, the gold list. And so of all of the, I guess, hundreds of entries they had, it was listed in this top 13. And then I thought, oh, wow, that's amazing. You know, and I was kind of happy with that and forgot all about it. And then suddenly, a couple of weeks later, they came back to me saying, you've made the final four. You're nominated for this award. And I was like, oh, this is...
God, this is exciting. I know you actually won this, and this is still exciting.
Yeah, building the tension. Okay. Well,
what happened next?
Yeah, well, I mean, my girlfriend was looking at them going, oh, that one looks good, doesn't it? And I was like, no, it looks terrible. Don't say that.
Shut up.
It's all right.
What would you know?
Yeah, but so, yeah, it came down to the final four, and then it was like...
What colour list was that, by the way? Gold? It was like 13. What colour?
It's beyond colour. I guess it's the entire spectrum because they never mentioned a colour.
Or was it like the scene in Indiana Jones when he's picking the goblets and he's picking the Holy Grail? Oh,
yes, exactly.
Was it like the pewter?
Well, possibly that's why I won. They chose the shittest one, but we'll...
that is indeed where it's true. Yeah.
This is the script of a carpenter.
Yeah. But yeah, so I... So they said I was nominated, at which point I was like... I said to my girlfriend, like, I don't know whether I should put this on social media. I'm someone who I dread doing stuff like that. I really hate doing it. I'm embarrassed by it. I hate other people who do it. And because I've kind of had these years of maybe not being able to find anyone to champion my work and stuff, and she kind of just said, well, if you're not going to celebrate yourself, no one else is going to do it. So that's when I kind of started sharing things, which I don't think you would have seen the first one, John, where I basically mentioned that it was on this gold list, etc. And then, so I thought, okay, maybe I should go up. And it was a lovely festival. And I met some wonderful filmmakers. I kind of buddied up with a guy who ended up winning the Best Director Award, which was nice. And we kind of just we watched lots of short films and feature films together. Went to the awards and got drunk. And so that was that was that. And it was a lovely time. And, you know, I keep kind of saying, like, I don't think it's a big deal because it's, I guess if you're a novelist and you... win an award for your book, then your book has already been realized to the extent that it ever will be. Mm. It's written and people read it and they imagine that story in their own minds. So you've kind of achieved the pinnacle of what that book can be. Whereas with a screenplay, it is kind of like the very start of a process, which in my mind isn't finished until the film itself is realized. Mm. And to me, if this is the first step on a journey, hopefully, then... that's what's the most important thing to me. Kind of winning an award for it being the best of something that it is yet not is kind of a difficult thing to get my head around. But then weirdly, after trying to be humble, I'm going to say 2 days ago, I found out that it's been longlisted for another award in America.
Oh, so, wow.
Oh, brilliant.
And what's that? What's
this one's this one's called the Golden Script Competition. And this one has 3,000 entries.
It's all gold, isn't it?
It's all
gold.
About the gold, baby.
Yeah.
But yeah, this one has over 3,000 entries. And so it's been it's been chosen as a quarter finalist, which is, I guess, within the top 100-ish.
Yeah.
So... the stress starts now because each 5 days they whittle it down to semi-finals, finals, and winner.
That's so American.
I know. Yeah. But this one actually has a prize of $10,000. But you know, I've got no kind of illusions of winning it or anything. But you know,
that's almost like 1% of a budget for a film.
Yeah, exactly. And
you could make the first 4 minutes with that.
yeah, true. But yeah, so I mean, again, to me, that's like, you know, if I can somehow take that and possibly even, you know, my plan is once I find out where it comes in that competition, if I can possibly then start approaching agents and going, look,
I've got the 64th best unproduced script in America.
Yeah, or at the very least, look, the thing that it's made me believe is that, like, I'm not trying to waste your time. Yeah. Like, you know, at the very least, I'm not terrible at this.
Yes.
And, you know, so please take me slightly more seriously than you may have done in the past. And that to me is the most important thing about it.
Yes.
One thing I will tell you, which will not make it into the podcast, hopefully, please cut this out.
We'll be the judge of that.
Well, no, please cut this out. So,
the following section of the podcast has been removed on the request of our legal team. Let's just see if we can go back.
Arrested.
Oh
Jesus.
Oh, no, just give it a minute. And we're back.
So yeah, anyway, that's the story.
Yeah.
Something you said before, which I was going to ask you about, in the whole writing sphere. Obviously, like you said, if you write novels, even if you write terrible novels, you can get them published. If you hack at poetry and write some absolutely god-awful stuff, Amazon will let you publish that with your own hand-drawn front cover. That's fine.
Yeah, you can get into a co-op anthology.
Yeah, you could. Over the good stuff, probably. But yeah, you with screenwriting, what a thing to pick, because you just... screaming into the void a bit, aren't you? And you're completely at the mercy of other people and lots of money happening to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Why would you do that for?
Well, I mean, I have, I think from a very young age, been quite film obsessive. And kind of anyone who knows me would say that it's kind of been my morning, noon and night of what I've been into in my life. So when I was very young, and I mean like 13, I decided to write a novel.
Right.
And I used to read quite like advanced books at a young age, I think. But I think I must have just read, or at least tried to read, Last of the Mohicans.
Right.
And also Around the World in 80 Days. Because I basically tried to write a mashup of that. In a...
Around the World in 80 yeah. haircuts.
yeah. In a... sorry. But
what was that mashup?
I've got no idea. I just remember, like, you know, because obviously I hadn't read much in my life at that point, but I know that, like, for instance, James Fenimore Cooper wrote Last of the Mohicans, and I pretty much just gave his name to my, like, Phileas Fogg-type character in my Around the World in 80 Days thing that I did. But I remember sitting down and thinking, I'm going to write the next great novel. And I sat down with, like, a lined copybook from school and a pen, and I probably hand-filled in about 20 pages of this copybook, which obviously... in a novel, it's probably about 2 pages. And I gave it to my dad to read. And my dad said, oh, that's very good, that. You should write a children's book. Which to 13-year-old me was like being shot through the heart. Because I thought, this is a seriously great novel. What are you talking about? So I kind of put it down and then forgot about writing until I went to uni and I studied film and television. And I did a screenwriting module. And it was the module I kind of scored highest at uni. And I really loved it. And kind of back to your point of, you know, because people always talk about kind of auteur theory and stuff in filmmaking.
Mm.
And to me, I've always found it kind of nonsensical. I think like auteurs, like filmmakers who have enough clout, choose the types of stories they want to tell. So that, which naturally, I think, leads you down a certain route. Obviously, filmmakers will impose a visual style.
Mm.
But filmmaking is by its nature a collaborative process.
Mm.
And, you know, or very few filmmakers. I mean, you could look at Steven Soderbergh and say, okay, he, you know, shoots, directs, edits, you know, often writes his own films. And he's able to do everyone's job as good as, if not better than they can. But generally speaking, it's collaborative. And that's the thing I love about it.
Mm.
Saying that, I, you know, having worked for the last, guts of the last 20 years in kind of TV, short form promos, directing commercials and that kind of thing, I love the idea of collaboration until you have to work with clients who think something different than you do, in which case it's the most soul-destroying thing in the world. So to me, I think I fell in love with screenwriting when doing all that other work, you know, which is where I met you, John. And so, you know, I guess you would have read some of my piss-poor scripts for promos over the years. And I would go away from work and then just be able to spend time in a world that I was creating that no one could give me feedback on. And I think I kind of, that's what drew me into it. And I've obviously never gotten to the point where anyone's gone, here's X amount of money to make this thing. So the scripts as they are now are kind of these very imperfect things because, you know, I often read them back and hate them. Weirdly, after I won the award, I read Pushing Daisy back and I was like, this is rubbish.
I'm glad you said that because I got a few, I've got a few things.
Oh, thanks, mate. Appreciate it.
You've got some notes.
I read it back and I really hated it. And like, you know, even if someone like gives you an award for something or tells you it's good, like I can only see the things I dislike. but at the same time, it's still a true representation of me when I wrote it. And I know that if someone says, let's make this thing, it's going to become something completely different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hopefully better. Often they could become worse.
Yeah.
But then that's another exciting journey. And if it never gets made, it's something that I'm passionate about and I love. And whilst I said earlier, it's an incomplete thing because it hasn't been made. When I read it back, I can still see it in my head exactly as if I was watching a film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
do you know what I just nearly said to you then?
What's that?
I was to say, well, if nothing else, I really enjoyed watching it. But then I realised I'd actually read it, hadn't I?
That is a good sign, though, isn't it? Because I had the same experience.
Yeah.
I totally lived it out. I can see the characters and everything.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Really I'm glad good. You enjoyed it. Really Thank good. You. Yeah, and it's I wrote it in a specific way that I think when you start writing it, you probably think it's going to be quite a dour drama. And hopefully it eventually kind of suddenly reveals itself as the opposite. Because I think I wrote it as a... Should I say what it's about for this to make sense?
I was going to put you on the spot and say, why don't you pitch it to us? Why don't you imagine that we're film producers?
And, imagine that we're important run about. Two rather large leaps, but yeah, we need this to work.
Yeah, imagine that what we say means anything at all.
Well, guys, as I said, I'm an avid listener to the podcast now, and I am very grateful to have been invited on here in the first place. So what you do say matters a lot to me.
you're among the stars
just
now.
Try not to be too nervous. Just about your little film.
Just relax.
Well, actually, when I went up and accepted the award the other week, The guy who handed it to me kind of completely...
Please tell me that you didn't... Part of your speech wasn't the bit about hating it. No, by the way, guys. I've reread it and I hate this now. Thanks for the award, but you don't know what you're about. Yeah.
No, he completely blindsided me and he said, well, now that you're here and there's loads of filmmakers in the room, why don't you pitch it to them?
Oh.
And I was like, oh, what? Oh, yeah, and it was really awkward.
What a great opportunity.
Yeah, thanks.
Shit.
Yeah, it was. Oh, it made me feel quite ill, but I stumbled through it in some.
What kind of arse would do that?
I know, seriously.
Who would just that's suddenly just so put your, mean. You know, like. Yeah, anyway, back to what John was saying about, sorry to spring it on you, but could you pitch it to us?
So I suppose it came out of lockdown. And I also, the other thing that I always think is so many people must have written pandemic stories, but this isn't, the pandemic to me is a vehicle in the background and it's not what it's about. So in your first couple of episodes, you talked a lot about log lines. And I know you always said that the ideal log line was 25 to 35 words. Well, mine is much shorter than that, which is... In the same way that, like, Speed was Die Hard on a bus, Pushing Daisy is the Irish octogenarian Thelma and Louise. That's how I describe it. Except, I think in their minds, the action is a lot bigger than what it actually is. So, yeah, so it was inspired by my grandmother, really. When lockdown happened, I started to think, and all the news came out about people locked in care homes and kind of cut off from the world. My grandmother lives in a care home in Ireland. She's now 89, she was 87 then, which is the age of the lead character, Noneen. And I just started thinking about kind of people who are in their kind of twilight years, probably in their own minds, don't have very much time left. And then someone basically locks them in the place they live and tells them that, you know, those precious few moments they have left are being taken from them. Which obviously is totally understandable why it was done, but at the same time, you can imagine what it must feel like to be those people. So I started thinking kind of about my grandmother in that scenario. So there are elements of my grandmother's life, but the story and everything else are nothing like her life or the life of my family. It's about this 87-year-old woman called Noneen, who has basically at some time in recent years, she's, to fill in some backstory, fell and broke her hip and as a result had a stroke. So she's very kind of mentally agile and whip smart with a retort, etc. But she is physically kind of quite slow and disabled. She has to use a walker or a wheelchair to get around with any speed. At the same time, there's a lady called Bobby who has dementia, who is physically very capable, but her mind is beginning to kind of let her down. And I think she is afraid that, you know, by the time we come out of lockdowns, etc., she'll be lost forever. So Bobby's physically capable, Noneen is mentally capable. And as lockdown happens, etc., Noneen, who has a very kind of tense relationship with her daughter dies from COVID. And Noneen is told by the nurse who runs the nursing home that she's not allowed to attend the funeral because of safety concerns. So Noneen is not someone who takes rejection lightly, and obviously while she's a very stoic woman who will never show her emotion, you know, obviously she's the mother of a child who she's not allowed to say goodbye to, and she decides along with Bobby to break out of the nursing home and go on a cross-country odyssey to attend the funeral. So, you know, I think I actually stole a line from, believe it or not, A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, where Noneen says, "What, you be the body and I'd be the brain," which is very similar to something Freddy Krueger says in Nightmare on Elm Street 2, but it kind of sums up the relationship. So they're mutually codependent as they break out of the nursing home and kind of not quite planes, trains and automobiles, but they go cross country across Ireland. Gráinne, who is the kind of matron nurse running the nursing home, and a young Garda police officer join up to go after them. Obviously, Noneen and Bobby think that it means they're going to end up in prison for breaking the law and that they're actually outlaws, Whereas in reality, Gráinne and the police officer, Garda Rory, just want to get to them and make sure they get to the funeral safe. So yeah, so I guess what sounds like quite a potentially depressing drama is actually more a comedy, I would say.
Yeah,
you probably call it a comedy drama, because hopefully the emotion isn't lost all the way through. And it's very, very Irish as well, which is why I'm also surprised an American screenwriting contest even understood what people were saying half the time.
I think that's one of its real strengths, though, as well. That it's placed in a very particular context, yeah.
That feel comes through it, doesn't it, very clearly. Yeah, 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 that quite.
But all the characters are very likable. I mean, there's one character that isn't very likable. Pretty much everyone else is. You know, you really do care about them all.
Weirdly, this basically is a first draft. It just kind of... everything else I've ever written, I've had to go over and rewrite. And this one just kind of...
Do you know how I knew it was a first draft, Paul?
It said first draft on the first page.
One of the clues.
was that I couldn't help but noticing that the Ford Focus that the old ladies steal magically turned into a Ford Fiesta.
There's a mistake. Don't you?
You're so pedantic.
You've pointed out a mistake.
I didn't want to, because I know what they think. Oh, it's been through the awards and stuff.
Is it too late? They can't take it back now, can they? The award is they've given it.
They can't take it back, but I can fix it. Thank you for saying that.
What would be terrible, though? I was thinking about this. What would be terrible if you did? But for some reason, that was the thing that made them... They thought, God, they've got all this, but hidden within it...
It's a metaphor for change. Like
transforming
mystical,
car.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that's what it all hinges around. That's really what brings this to this. That's amazing. That was the thing that really stood it out. And then you're, no, change that. I'm going to change that back.
I'll tell you what, for you, if it ever does get made, I will change the make of the car in every shot that it's seen in.
And then, yeah, and that can then go, have you spotted the real meaning?
You know what? I'm not going to sleep tonight knowing that.
I know.
Thank
I'm
you.
So sorry.
No, but I'm glad you did say it though, because you know, this is why I'm glad it's not a novel, because if it was printed 10,000 times on shelves in shops or on Amazon to be downloaded, I'd be like,
yeah, and that would guaranteed be one of the bad reviews on Goodreads or Amazon. I can only give this one star.
As an auto enthusiast.
as a descendant of Henry Ford. Cool. This isn't a personal attack.
But you know what I did think was wonderful about it? And again, this might sound like an insult, but it's really not. And it was quite heartening, really, because I think it's something I've always struggled with my writing, is the feel that you need to reinvent the wheel or do something completely different to do something good. And it just wasn't. It was such lovely... Yeah. Do you know what I mean? There was a certain enough predictability in it to feel comfortable with it, but enough twist in the story to keep you interested. But it wasn't trying to be something completely world-changing, genre-busting.
No.
And I think that was quite reassuring in a way for me as a writer.
I'm glad you said that, actually, because...
Good, because I wasn't sure how that was going to go down.
he hangs up.
Read like a proper film.
It's very much... cliche after cliche, trite trope after trite trope, and I think it really works.
Oh, thank you, Tom. I appreciate that. No, for me, this probably goes back to my philosophy with films in general. My philosophy as a guy who's never made a feature film. I am someone who I get very bored of myself very quickly in a way. So everything I write, I try and do something completely different to the last thing I wrote. And this particular thing, as I said, started off quite cynically in that I wanted to write something cheap. And once I hooked into that emotional thing that it meant something to me and my grandmother and all that kind of stuff, to me, I suppose I always write something in order to achieve a feeling within myself and or make myself feel a certain way. So for me, this story was about an emotional impact, and it almost didn't matter if it was a... Like, it shouldn't have to be, oh, this is a completely new way of doing a film. If anything, that distracts from the emotional... Yeah. Center of what the story is. And the story should feel familiar, but hopefully, as you said, possibly pull the rug from under you a few times.
Exactly.
Whereas, like, the film I wrote before that, which I'm at the minute tinkering with again, is like a 1930s style screwball comedy set in the Midwest of America. It's completely different. And then the next thing I'm doing is something which is not trying to reinvent the wheel, but it's like a sci-fi time travel thing, which is much more complex and something that I'm going to have to actually plan out a lot more. Whereas with Pushing Daisy, I thought I had an idea of the story I wanted to tell, and I had an ending which I wanted to get to. You know, it's the idea of of a woman finding closure and possibly even finding the good in herself as well. Then I kind of just let it take me where it would take me, which involved a series of kind of mini adventures within the overall adventure, each one of which is slightly a comedy setup in a way, but hopefully pushes the characters on a bit further. So to me, it's like I try and adapt myself to the story I'm telling rather than, you know, I worship screenwriters like Charlie Kaufman and people who do reinvent the wheel with everything they do. But I often think they bend stories to themselves, whereas I prefer to adapt myself to the story. And that's why I'm so much more successful than they are.
Exactly, yeah. You've got the recipe.
Yeah, exactly. And you can learn all about it in my new book, which is coming out now.
Obviously, if this film was ever greenlit, presumably one of the first things that would happen is that the script would be torn out of your sweaty little palms and given to a team of writers. I don't know how it works. I'm just kind of assuming that screenplays tend to get kicked around a lot before they're, you know, deemed finished. They're developed for quite a long time. Does that tend to happen? And does the idea of that excite you or terrify you?
The idea of that terrifies me, but I would say that in the case of this script, I think if I had been writing Transformers 7, which weirdly this script started out as, which is why the car changes constantly throughout. But you know, I think had this been Transformers 7 and it was like a Hollywood, this is from my kind of like outsider knowledge, then yes, possibly it would be pulled apart. I think for something this small and intimate, it's possible they might want to buy it off me and not have me involved again. But I would say it's less likely. I think in kind of smaller, more intimate films like this, the original writer would tend to, especially when it's such a personal story, tend to see it all the way through.
Okay.
Yeah. Whereas I think the bigger the budget goes, the more likely more people will get their hands on it.
I see. Okay. And what kind of budget would you need for a film like this?
I reckon you could probably do it. I mean, you know, I say it as if it's no money at all, but I reckon you could probably do it quite comfortably for about £3 million.
Wow.
Which, you know, as films go, is very low budget. But actually, in reality, it might cost a little bit more than that, because it's one of these, you know, I speak to people who make independent films all the time and they say, oh, we shot this in 15 days and no one slept. And in reality, in the you know, as a responsible wannabe filmmaker, your two lead characters are women in their 80s. You can't expect them to work like a 25-year-old would. So in reality, you probably need shorter days and a longer shoot in order to make them feel comfortable and get the best performances out of them, and like not try and kill these people just because we don't have that much money. I think sometimes you see, especially low budget filmmakers who make everything about themselves, or you know, this is about getting my film made, getting my vision out there, no matter what it does to anyone else. And in reality, if I was to be able to kind of move over into this part of the industry and do this kind of job, I would want everyone involved in it to have as good a time as possible and as enjoyable a time as possible and get something from it, rather than all of them be run ragged and just be used by me for my vision or whatever.
And have a terrible reputation forever.
Exactly. But there are so many people who are like that and they still work because their films do well, and that's all that really matters.
They came from a dying world. Their mission, to save ours.
We have to escape or the whole world will end. But there's no way out.
Oh, yes, there is. Between those buildings.
You're crazy. We'll never fit this Ford Focus through that gap.
No problem.
Huh?
Because I'm not just a Ford. I'm a Transformer.
Starring Helen Rearview Mirren.
Oh, my God. It's changing into a Ford Fiesta.
Nissan Ewell L. Jackson.
We'll fit now. Good job, Bumbletron. So long, suckers.
And featuring the voice of Matt Daimler.
You're welcome.
What's happening?
Oh, yeah. Only problem. I've transformed into a diesel model, and you filled me with unleaded this morning, so... Oops.
Oh, bugger.
Transformer 7. Time to go electric.
What was the first screenplay you actually wrote then?
So the first one I finished
was it at uni?
At uni, we had to write the first 30 pages of a screenplay.
Right. Okay.
And I somehow got a first for it, even though I didn't know what the story was. I just started writing this interesting kind of like world, and the lecturer really bought into it. So that was that. But when I'm in my early 20s, I wrote a screenplay, which is I alluded to earlier, which I've come back to recently, which is this 1930s set screwball comedy, kind of a Preston Sturges maybe style, Howard Hawks style story set in the Midwest about a reporter from Chicago who goes on the road to find the real America during the Great Depression. He's quite an idiot who you kind of like, you know, he's quite pompous and everything else. And he ends up in this small town where he's mistaken as a gangster. And basically all the gangsters in America have come to this small town in order to take over the dairy supply of this town and replace it with alcohol, which then they can deliver legitimately to all the houses in America. So that was the first thing I wrote. And it's completely like insane and off the wall, and it's all about fast talking dialogue is something I get quite obsessed by, and kind of I love the way people speak to each other and how that defines them and that kind of thing. So I wrote that, and it was like that kind of screwball comedy that's 180 pages long, it's a 3-hour screwball comedy, and so I just forgot all about that, and then weirdly went back to it, looked at it a couple of years ago and thought, you know what, there's something in this. So I've kind of fixed it up lately, and I'm really proud of that one. And
sounds brilliant.
It does. Great premise.
Yeah,
it's kind of it's ridiculous, but hopefully in a good way. It almost has an element of Looney Tunes to it. It has, it's like a bad imitation of the Coen brothers, all kind of in one.
Yeah, it's so hard to know what will be made, though, isn't it? It's like you just have to write what amuses you or what you enjoy writing, and then
this is
something we're learning.
Yeah, definitely something that comes apart this week.
And it's difficult. I think I've always shot myself in the foot because when I have like my commercial representation and stuff, they'll always go, oh, you've done a bit of food stuff, all right, so let's get you loads of food jobs, or you've done a bit of this, let's get you. And everyone's always looking to label you, and I've always wanted to be someone who, I suppose the thing, like, you know, back when, you know, you were voicing promos with me and stuff, John, is like the thing about promos I do like is when they're short is that you always switch between genres and styles, and you're always trying to adapt yourself to different things. And as a person and as a writer, which I find weird even calling myself that now, but I actually do believe I am, I always try and do different things. And when I was directing stuff, it kind of meant that it was really hard to get me work, because if you go to one ad agency, they want someone who's done only food stuff or only car stuff or only, and it's an absolute nightmare that you can.
I wouldn't trust you with bloody car stuff, Paul. Halfway through the advert, they go, this is a different car.
Yeah, I know. Ford gave us £2 million to make this, and you've made a Toyota ad. And it's always been a constant source of frustration for me. And I am now also facing the same thing, I guess, because I love writing. Like, you know, I wrote an Irish set horror film basically about the child abuse scandals in the 60s, you know, like I'm writing this sci-fi time travel thing now. I've written something I want to go back to because I was quite young and probably didn't research it properly, like a World War One kind of action war epic, but just slightly based on a true story. Every time, to keep myself interested, I have to change the genre and the style and challenge myself to adapt to that. But I do worry now if I go to agents and they go, well, we don't know how to sell you as a writer. Are you a comedy writer? Are you a drama writer?
But you can only do that, can't you? The worst thing you could do would be to say, right, I will just write rom-coms. That's all I'm going to do now. And I'm going to become a rom-com writer.
And hate it every day.
Yes, if that's not who you are, then you can't, can you?
Yeah, but I think it also comes back around to maybe what we said at the beginning, which is like, I can either sit here and worry about all the things that might not be or might be or people might box me in with, or I can just let them tell me they don't like they think I should be this, that or the other, or tell me they don't like my stuff. And I'm in no worse a position than I was, but at least I tried. So
yeah, it's very much something to not worry about, isn't it? Until you actually achieve something. It's like our Jonathan Ross moments getting in our way.
Yeah.
Paul, I'm going to ask you. I'm going to ask you one more question because we've taken up a lot of your time. I want to know what you're up to next. Have you got more writing plans?
Yes.
Got anything else in the pipeline?
I touched on this a little bit earlier. I'm starting to develop a kind of time travel screenplay, which is, in my mind, it's a slightly novel take on time travel.
Oh, right. Okay. Interesting.
I'm still trying to work out the full story, but I kind of have my beginning and end, which is what I always look for. And then I kind of try to get from one to the other. But obviously, it being a time travel story, it's going to be quite complex. So I'm going to plan this one out properly before I start writing.
That's a good idea. Yeah. I'm trying to write a time travel book. I don't know if you've got to that point in the podcast.
I don't think so. I'm on ep 14. At the minute, you're talking about your sentient trees.
Ah, yes.
Oh, they're still around. They're still around.
You have to wait a while.
Oh, really? Oh, I cannot wait.
That turned out a lot better than John expected. It has to be said.
Oh, don't tell. I wanted to find out when do we actually get to hear it?
Oh, well, that will be telling.
Can't reveal that.
But yeah, that's really difficult, isn't it, to write time travel stuff? My brain just can't get around it very easily. I probably shouldn't have chosen that genre, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm a sucker for all the Marvel multiverse things and all that kind of stuff. And I'm a huge fan of Everything Everywhere All at Once. I don't know if any of you guys have seen
that. Oh, no, I really want to see that. It's amazing.
Seen that.
An absolute work of genius.
Yeah.
Like, my favorite film of all time is Back to the Future. And what I like about Back to the Future is the simplicity of its concept. Yeah. So the one thing that I really want to hold on to is the simplicity of, it's all nonsense, right? So when people go, oh, the time travel mechanics of that don't really work, it's because it's all a load of nonsense.
Yeah, I love it when people do that with things.
But it's like, but what you have to do is convince people just to trust you.
Yeah.
And if the story you're telling is good enough.
Yeah. And then it becomes about the characters.
Yeah, yeah. And the nonsense is delivered in the right way.
That's it.
Then
exactly.
That's all that matters.
If it's entertaining.
So
I think it's with those things, it's as long as there are actually some rules.
Exactly.
That's what it needs.
So keep the rules simple. So Back to the Future, my core concept, I won't say how time travel works, because that's the bit I quite like. But it's that if you go back in time and change something, it changes now. There's no splintering timelines.
There's
no multiverses created from that. And if you keep it that simple, then it allows you to get on with the story without getting bogged down in everything else, I think.
And again, it makes no sense that that is the case, because I spent so much time thinking about whether that would actually work or not. And of course it doesn't.
But it doesn't matter,
like you say.
Basically, the more simple you keep it, the less holes people can find when they're watching it. Because if people are looking for holes when they're watching it, then your story is not very good.
As long as it's being consistent, isn't it? It's picking something.
Absolutely.
Sticking to it. I still think that the way it worked in Bill and Ted is possibly my favourite, where if they were in a tricky situation, they'd just say, don't worry, we'll come back later in the time machine. Leave a key there. No, that's just genius.
I love it. I absolutely love that. And there's a great Spanish film called Time Crimes.
No, I don't know.
If none of you have seen it, I would highly recommend it. And there's a Japanese one from this year or last year, which was made for hardly any money. And it's about a guy who lives above a coffee shop. And on his TV screen or his computer screen, there is a link that appears to the security camera in the coffee shop. But what he realizes is that his video feed of the coffee shop is 3 minutes in the future. And from that simple premise, the film is incredibly wonderful and inventive and mind-blowingly.
I bet that works in Japanese sort of things. Whereas if that was here, you'd just have him running across to the bookies and back, wouldn't you?
Exactly, But it involves him then speaking to himself in the future on the other end of the link. And I can't for the life of me remember the name of the film now. I will find it and send it on. It's well worth seeing.
We'll send the link on.
That sounds brilliant.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Paul.
Yes, thank you very much indeed.
It's been lovely chatting
to you. My pleasure.
To
you. And thank you very much for making me feel like
you are an actual writer. You're allowed to
say
it.
Officially a gold standard writer.
Really, really, really enjoyed reading the script.
Yeah, fantastic.
Really,
well, thank you very much, lads. Appreciate it.
And I was ready to hate it, because anything that John brings to either me or Dave and goes, oh, this is good. Right, whatever. And then we really try and hate it, but I couldn't.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind and means a lot. And may the podcast go on, because I thoroughly enjoy it.
Thank you very much.
I look forward to hearing your adventures in writing.
Thanks,
Pleasure
Paul.
To speak to you. Thanks, Paul.
Take care,
thanks, buddy.
Bye-bye.
Cheers, bye.
Take care.
Well, that was Paul, and that was great, wasn't it?
That was excellent.
That was...
He doesn't know his... I told you he knew his film stuff. There were several bits in there where he was mentioning, like, avant-garde films or whatever.
Spanish.
And you could see we were all just a bit like...
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And he... Have you seen that one?
Is that the one with... Yeah.
Is that the one with Eddie Murphy? No, it's not. He's not in the Japanese. Right, okay. No, I haven't then. But it's great. I was saying off air to you guys after the end of the interview. It's just fantastic, isn't it? Getting people that are just kind of making some headway into it. It's quite exciting on his behalf, I think.
It feels like it's bubbling up.
Possibilities. These possibilities. And it might end in nothing. It might not. Or they might get a big break. Or they're just... And it's just... it's quite...
Sometimes it's nice to have really well-made chips, isn't it? But sometimes it's good to unearth a fresh new potato from the ground.
Is that what you've been doing in the 2 weeks off, Dave? Just perfecting your metaphors? That's amazing.
Taking the potato and washing it down,
buffing it up, and
then Dave, before we started recording today, he's going, I'm gonna. You know what I'm gonna do? What are you gonna do? I'm gonna use the potato one.
Are you?
You can do the chip potato mouth.
Potato.
I've been polishing it for 2 weeks now. I'm gonna get it out. Yes, you know it is exactly like that, Dave.
Yes, it really is exactly like that,
isn't it?
Yeah. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you, Paul, for being our new potato. Much appreciated. I did notice, Dave, at the start, when we asked what we've been writing this week, you didn't mention the love story.
Oh, yeah.
No.
You're not started on that one.
What love story is that?
I don't know if you remember, Dave. You probably do from listening to last week's episode, but I'm sure you did.
Oh, yeah. I am an avid listener. I'm sure you did. I mean, that's the only way we get our download number.
Me and you agreed to write a love story on the back of John's massive successful tree story, that we should write one. We should write a love story. So
I'm not sure I did agree to that.
Well, you have technically agreed.
We do have evidence, Dave.
Yeah, so you listened to the end of last week's episode.
Play it to me.
Well, this is what you said last week. Dave, do you fancy writing a romance story?
Oh, what a wonderful idea. Yeah, I can't think of anything better. Let's do that.
Sounds really keen, actually, doesn't he?
Ah, right. No, I think that might be a sarcastic reply. Let's see if we've got a bit more of a genuine one.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Let's do that.
So there, yeah.
Oh, right. Ooh. Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Probably legally binding then, isn't it? So
the idea is, I think we'd do it so we can present them back on the show. We'll call it a 500 word, like a nice short thing.
500 words. Yep, I can do that.
Sounds doable,
and,
doesn't it?
Any romance you like.
Any link to romance. Yes.
It has to be a love story.
Well, I think because it came off the back of John's tree love story, obviously the boundaries are unlimited, aren't? If you can do stuff with that.
That's
then,
true, yeah.
That's like whatever. Have an alien falling in love with a car, whatever. It's all cool.
Right.
It's all cool.
500 words, romance.
Yeah.
Bosh.
And we'll do that in a few weeks' time. We won't put a hard deadline on it, Dave. We'll put a soft
deadline. No, we don't work well to hard deadlines, do we? So
in the future-ish soon.
Right. Brilliant.
Done.
Are you going to write one as well, John?
Another one?
I know. I suddenly thought, why not? Why not? You could do, couldn't you?
Why not?
Of course I am. Yeah, I'll put another one out as well. Yeah,
it could be, because it could be a good starter for another one of your anthologies, couldn't it?
Well, exactly. I've got to write them, haven't I? So I might as well. Yeah. Okay.
Get some ideas out.
I'm on it.
Nothing says love and romance more than churning out one thing after another.
Forcing someone to write something they don't want to write. Yeah.
Exactly, no, yeah. Great. Well, so we've got that coming up. Have we got anything else coming
up? Nothing worth noting. Nothing worth mentioning, I would imagine.
Fair enough.
I know what we've got coming up.
Actually, what we have got coming up, Dave, next week is finally time for you to face the music. We are going to critique your spooky war book.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to that.
Sadly, what I did realise was I had got halfway through it, and because it's been so long since I was halfway through it, I have to bloody start it again and do it all in one.
Yeah.
Sounds happy about that.
John, I don't really like reading stuff. You know that.
Noticed, yeah.
But I did enjoy it when I did it.
Doing it again.
I'm probably not going to enjoy it a second time, Dave. So it's probably going to affect your rating.
It's going to be like that like that second cup of tea, innit? You have a cup of tea and you think, that's lovely.
Yeah.
And then you make another one and you go, it's just not quite as good now. It's not the same.
Dave's going to come off this and go, I did the tea metaphor. I did the potato metaphor. I tell you, I was on fire. I really was. 2 weeks off. I've come back. They're going to realise what... I'm going to show them what they've missed.
Do you know, I've got nothing for next week now, have I?
I've used them all. I've used everything.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to that. I'm actually looking forward to finishing it. I haven't quite finished it for the second time. I've read it twice, Dave. That's how much I love this
almost, book. You've almost read it twice.
Unbelievable.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward
you
to
should
it.
Probably have a read up on it as well.
Yeah,
Dave, you can't remember it.
Bloody word. So, I'll gen up on it. But no, it'd be nice to hear some actual feet. Because no one's ever, apart from you guys, no one's ever read it. And you haven't even read it. So, you know.
Well, I'm going to have to read it again anyway, because I remember when I was reading it, I did kind of get, and I think I said this at the time, which was a good sign. I kind of got through it and thought, oh, shit, I'm going to be taking notes or something on this. And I was just kind of reading it for enjoyment. I was like, hold on a minute, yeah. I'm not meant to be enjoying this.
Oh, don't enjoy it, Tom.
Maybe I need to read it with a more critical eye.
Yes, good. Well, I look forward to that.
Yeah.
So, tune in here next week. You want to hear someone's hopes and dreams smashed against the rocks. Oh, yeah.
Our bi-weekly dream ruining. Yay! Well, that concludes today's podcast. So, thank you all for listening.
It's been joyful.
And because it's a screenplay special, let's just say, cunt!
Hello.
Hello.
Where's everybody gone?